So, you know, my teacher was not one for scriptures because he felt that was too theoretical. And he would keep talking about its application in daily living. And he would say, what is the impact of a teaching and how can it be measured? Is by the peace of mind you feel in your daily living. Because if there's no measure to what you're going after, what's the point of it? We are not here to just acquire more knowledge. So today I want to explore the sheer fact that peace of mind is our natural state, even when we are not at peace. And then you can really see God's compassion because the gift He has given us, which we've taken for granted, you know, this points you back towards that gift. So the first thing is we've expressed gratitude to God for a lot of things in our life, for everything which is positive, for relationships, for family, whatever may be. If you made money, if you've had any good happen to you, you've probably expressed gratitude to God. But I wonder how many of us have expressed gratitude to God for deep sleep? Because 1/3 of our day is in deep sleep, and in deep sleep, there's no anxiety, there's no fear, there's no ill will, there's no spite, there's no jealousy, there's no envy, there's no hatred. And no matter how bad the day is, in deep sleep, it all disappears. So the most peace which we have experienced is because of deep sleep. We are at peace. So you could think of all the suffering you've gone through in life, all the ups and downs, all the heartaches, the breakdowns you've had, but you have been still given the gift of deep sleep. Most of us have that gift. So 1/3 of our lives, we are at peace. Simple. Now the thing is, why are we at peace in deep sleep? The reason we are at peace is because we as individuals don't exist in deep sleep. When you have deep sleep and you wake up, you don't remember anything about the deep sleep, but you say, I slept well. So as individuals, we don't exist in deep sleep, but in the waking state, we exist, we have our lives, we have our relationships, we have our troubles. And that goes asleep in deep sleep. But still, we wake up in the morning and say, I slept well. Now, how could you sleep well if you were not present in deep sleep? And who knows that you slept well? Because when you were asleep, there was nobody there. So how can you get up and say, I slept well? So the person who says, I slept well, must be present in deep sleep as well as in the waking state in order to claim that it slept well. It's a very important thing to look at. You can look at your own experience. If you say, Neend bahut acha aaya, I slept very well, but where were you? So it's very clear that the absence of you and your story was the presence of deep sleep. So that peace we have all tasted, but we don't know it because we were not there. But the joke is that that peace does not leave the waking state. Otherwise, you cannot say, I slept well. Because there is something which has to be in deep sleep as well as in the waking state as a constant to say, I slept well. And that is the foundation of your being in the waking state as well, which is consciousness. If you were not conscious, you couldn't say, I slept well. You wouldn't wake up in the morning. So consciousness is a continuum from deep sleep to dream state to waking state. And the sheer fact that you say you slept well means that state is with you even in the waking state, no matter what your troubles and what your problems. So the peace of deep sleep does not go away with deep sleep. It just gets covered with all our misery in the waking state. And we just forget our true nature, which is the depth of peace, which is consciousness. Now what happens is, consciousness is like electricity. And we are like instruments in a kitchen. So one person is a mixer grinder, one person is a toaster, one person is a microwave oven. We are instruments through whom the consciousness functions. So without consciousness, we couldn't perform our functions. The toaster couldn't make toast, the microwave cannot cook food, heat food. None of it, we would be dead bodies, the instruments would be dead instruments in the kitchen, unless consciousness flows through them, which is electricity in their case. But what happens with us, the same consciousness, in deep sleep, the consciousness is there. But in the waking state, we become identified with our bodies. So this becomes me, and that becomes you, and that becomes he, and that becomes she. So the toaster says, I am a toaster, and tells the microwave, you are a microwave. And then the microwave says to the mixer grinder, you are the mixer grinder. And that's how the separation begins, and they all lose sight of the fact that they are working in the kitchen because of electricity. But the electricity does not mind, because it knows that it's the force behind these instruments. That's what happens to us in the waking state. We forget that the same consciousness animates all of us. And we start personalizing things. We become identified packets based on what happened to us from childhood till now. All our conditioning, all our programming, all our innate natures, tendencies, flaws. We become these individual packets of all this, and we start fighting with each other, physically, verbally, emotionally, thinking that that person is separate from me. But if you were not conscious, where's the fight? And the other person, if the other person was not conscious, where's the fight? So in the waking state, we become identified with our bodies and our story, our life story. And then we start proclaiming judgment on other people. And how does that happen? Because we think that I am separate from you. And so you are an object in my field of perception. So right now when you're looking at me, I am an object. And you all are objects in my field of perception. Now if you are an object, I consider myself as the subject. And so you looking at me now, you think that you are the subject and I am the object. Because you're looking at me, I become the object in your field of consciousness. Now you think you're looking at me, and then you pronounce judgment. How is he? Why is he doing this? Who does he think he is? You know, this fellow is a very angry fellow. I don't know what his problem. Now you have assumed you are the subject and the other person is the object. So you start judging the object. But you don't realize that you are equally an object in the manifestation. So actually one object is judging another object. This is Maya. This is in scriptures what they call Maya. Is this, that we are all one, but we act as if we are not. Now tomorrow if you had a fight with someone, or you didn't agree with someone, the one way of looking at it is, you don't need to justify your position because you are not right. Nothing is right and nothing is wrong. You can state your position, but your job is not to convince the other. Because how do you know what they are seeing based on their conditioning is their truth? You know, so you will have to see that. You can see it in a clear light that when you're talking with someone who agrees or disagrees with you is irrelevant, because just like you, whatever they say and think is based on how their parents treated them. How they were in school, were they quiet, were they the rowdy types, how the teachers treated them, were they taken to temples and churches. So they've become bundles of conditioning based on which they react and respond. Just like us. Now when you see people that way, your fight loses its fight. Because you'll internally smile and say, you know, it's fine. What's happening is fine, because that's exactly the way the person has been shaped by a lot of events which are beyond their control. So who am I to try and change people? For even myself, instead of changing things, trying to convince people about points of view, why not just accept first that that consciousness is functioning through each and every one and bringing out exactly what it was meant to bring out at that point in time. So it's not about going into the scriptures of Maya and all. I'm just saying, look at it in your daily experience. If you are critical of yourself, don't forget that a lot of conditioning which you were subjected to was not in your control. So you have to be nicer to yourself, because God made things that way. You didn't choose where you would be born, you didn't choose your parents, you didn't choose the economic environment you'd be born in, you didn't choose the geographical environment, the social environment in which you received your conditioning, just like everyone else. So much has not been in our control, but then we think we are in control of our lives. So we have to be gentler on people and gentler on ourselves and realize that the same God, consciousness, the source, is functioning through everyone. We may not like people. I'm not saying go and hug everyone, because you have your preferences. You have what your system is based on. But you have to understand there's no question of hating anyone. And why is there no question of hating anyone? It's very simple. When I hate someone else, that hate is inside me, because I am feeling the hate. The other person doesn't probably know that I hate him. Now, first of all, if I am conscious, only then can I hate someone. If I'm a dead body, I can't hate anyone. If I am conscious, I can hate someone. Now that hate is felt by me within my consciousness. So the hate is arising within myself. So by hating someone, I'm hating myself. And this is not theory. You can see it for yourself. The other person is just a mirror to make the emotion of hate come up. But the fact is, it is in my experience, the hate. So the hate is for whom? The other? That's delusion. That is why the gurus, Sai Baba, the biggest gurus, say, we are not telling you to love everyone. All we are saying is, don't harm another. Whether through thought, word, deed. Because in doing so, you are harming yourself. Because all there is consciousness in which all this is arising. And when they say love all and they focus on love and serve, it is for consciousness, because consciousness is love. Electricity is electricity flowing through everyone. So what they are doing is telling you, take back your original position rather than being mired in this leela of separation of me versus the other. That's what they are trying to say. So next time any of these feelings arise, you have to see them in a clear light. You know, explore it. Don't go and judge the fact that it arose, that why did I feel hate? Because that becomes another judgment. But witness it. Witness your feeling towards someone who's really bugging the daylights out of you in your life. You know, next time try and just be there as the presence through which that feeling arises within you, and you will realize it's the feeling within you. The other person's not really doing anything. Some people really have this knack of pushing the wrong buttons, you know. But it's your buttons which are getting pushed. The other person's just doing exactly what he was meant to do. So until you live this experience, you won't really know what it means. But it is far easier, at least my experience was, I could never go for spiritual lectures and talks. I did for a while, but it was being left at the level of theory. But I had a teacher who told me to look at things from a daily living, feeling, experiencing point of view, because peace of mind in daily living is what everyone is looking for, whether they know it or not. So this teaching invites you to feel it in life. Because life is relationships. Whether it is your parents, whether it's your children, whether it's your people at work, the beggar on the road, the dog on the street, what is your relationship with people, and are you comfortable with them or uncomfortable with them? That is the key to life. So any relationship, even if it's a beggar who comes knocking on the door of your car, on the window, and you react, what are you reacting for? What is the reaction about? Is it a natural, spontaneous reaction? Or are you having the story in your head about, you know, what does he think? Who does he think he is? Why is he knocking on the glass so hard? How dare he? So suddenly what Eckhart Tolle refers to as the witnessing presence, that starts to come up. You start seeing things, your own reactions, other people's reactions, and that knee-jerk judgment, that starts reducing because something gets separated from the reaction. That is the witnessing presence. You feel, even when you react, you know, you realize, my God, you know, this reaction has just come about. But you don't take ownership of the reaction. You cannot claim, the ego, what it does is it says, I am feeling fearful, I am feeling anxious. The ego claims ownership of everything. Some people are prone to fear. Some people are prone to anxiety. So next time anxiety arises, let it arise and honor anxiety for what it is. Anxiety is arising, witness the arising of the anxiety and witness it subsiding. But the trouble is we get involved in the anxiety and say, I should not get anxious. Why am I anxious? Why did God make me this way? What can I do not to get anxious? That is the trouble. Everything should be allowed to arise. If you're suffering, let it arise. There's no point suppressing the suffering. The problem is the I am suffering and I should not be suffering. So we are living in the past or we are projecting into the future. That's what we are doing. That's what the ego is about. Because it is afraid to die. We are all afraid to die. We are afraid of death. That is any form of fear which is coming up in life, no matter how small or how big, is the fear of the ego dying. That is the hard truth. The ego simply wants to sustain itself through whatever it identifies with, whether it's people, whether it's money, whether it's relationships, because it cannot bear the thought of dying. So, whenever you see yourself involved, you will realize I'm involved because I'm invested in the future or because someone or something from the past is keeping on playing again and again. If you are not involved, you will be in the present moment. That is what they say about being in the now. Being in the now is actually very tricky because you cannot not be in the now. The fact that you are alive, you are born and you will die, is the present moment. Because before your birth you were not there and after your death you won't be there. That is the now. So you cannot not be now. What is meant by not being in the present moment is when the thinking mind goes into the past and lives in the past, or goes into the future worrying about itself. So what is not in the now is the thinking mind. And sometimes when you're lost in something and you suddenly realize, my God, I was lost in a stream of thinking. Who is it that realized that you were lost in a stream of thinking? Not the same person who was involved in the thinking, because that person was involved in the thinking. But something snaps the thinking and you say, my God, what happened here? You know, I was really involved in this. But that snapping is actually what I refer to as grace. It is a force which snaps the involvement in thinking. The ego, which is the thinking mind, cannot snap itself. Something needs to snap. But what we do is then we try to say, okay, next time I'm going to be very careful. If something negative arises, I'm going to be there. and I'm going to try and snap it. That cannot happen because that is the involvement. But the ego wants to claim ownership of everything, that even I manage to be in the present moment. Because its job is to claim, you know, that I was successful in being in the present moment, I was a failure in being in the present moment. There's no such thing. But when the understanding sinks in deeper and deeper and deeper, you will realize, you'll see life in a different way, in a different light. Your relationship with people will change. And they will tell you what has happened, what has shifted. Because you're not doing anything, you're allowing it to naturally happen. So you're worshipping that same source, the same consciousness which is functioning through everyone, and honoring it for whatever it throws up. So live it, you know what I'm trying to say is, it should not be just a theory, because you can see it in reflection in your daily life. My teacher gave a very good example all the time of a surgeon. If he has to do an operation, he is in a working mind mode. All his experience is brought together. He has to decide, okay, where do I make the incision? How do I do it? The ego is in the present moment, in the working mind. Now, supposing somebody tells him that, look, you're operating on a very important politician. If it goes wrong, your practice is ruined. Now he's operating with that input. And he says, shit man, if I make a wrong incision or something goes wrong, I had it. My career is ruined. What am I going to do? Worried about the future. That is the thinking mind. The ego needs the future or the past to survive. But when you are in the working mind mode, there is no involvement because you are focusing on the task at hand. That is why it's always good to take up some work, even if it's social work, if it's creative work, because the mind is in the working mind mode. An idle mind is a devil's workshop, means a thinking mind. And a mind which is idle tends to start creating stories about the past and future and living there. So being in the now actually means that you cannot not be in the now unless you're in the past or future. So you really don't need to do anything to be in the now, because you are in the now. So it's a default setting. It's just that we move away from that. You know, we go this way or we go this way. And the emphasis of teachers is on witnessing, which is not an aspect of the ego as the thinking mind. So you cannot think yourself into witnessing. Witnessing arises when the thinking mind is absent. Witnessing is not a function of the thinking mind. So we all try to, you know, we've read all these books and say, okay, I should try to be in the now. That can't happen, because the now is the absence of that which wants to be in the now. It's a very tricky thing. So I would say that don't suppress any feeling. Don't suppress any negative thought which you have called negative. Be friends with it. You know, if you're feeling guilty about something, feel it. Don't judge the fact that you're feeling guilty about it, because the ego is coming in through the back door. You know, so be gentle on yourselves, gentle on others. Realize that all this is disappearing in deep sleep. How true could it be if it disappears for 8 hours of the day? How true could your problems be? Honestly, it just looks like that, because we come back, when we wake up, the ego comes back and claims ownership of everything. But at least God has given you the gift of deep sleep, because it just gets wiped out. And then he waits for some people to realize that they should understand that things which are not there all the time are unreal. So what is there all the time? It's your consciousness. So we are focusing on the waking state and all our issues there, thinking that is real. That is not our experience in deep sleep. So you got to question, how real is this? And if I am still alive between the deep sleep, dreaming and waking state, That must be real. Because that is there throughout. What is that? That is the constant. And that constant is consciousness. Which in deep sleep, it becomes impersonal because you don't know that you exist. You don't even know you have a body in deep sleep. And in the waking and dreaming state, it becomes identified. Me. So the sages say the me is not the problem to function in life. Even if a sage has been called by his name, he's going to respond, yes, what can I do for you? That is the functioning of life. So the me is not the problem. The problem comes when the me thinks that I am in charge of everything, including my thoughts, words, feelings, emotions, and what I do and what others do, which is the sense of doership. So if you take the person you really don't like on one side, and you take a robot on the other side, and you tell both of them to abuse you, will you be upset by the robot abusing you? You'll accept he's a robot. You know, you're not going to abuse the robot back. Why? Another person abuses you, you're abusing the person back. Who do you think you are? How dare you say this? This is my point of view. This is what I think about you. Because you're convinced that he is separate from you and he has done things to hurt you. So you want to hurt him back. But with a robot, that agenda does not arise. If you truly understand that we, in that sense, are robots, because God gave us certain tendencies, He created our conditioning, He created what we feel, everything. So we are reacting based on our programming. And you will start seeing the electricity which is functioning through the person and not the individual. Because you will realize that in a sense, we are all these programmed packets of consciousness as identified consciousness, but the same consciousness is flowing through each and every one of us. So you start accepting people more easily. Your defenses start going down. You become more open as a person, and you start accepting yourself as a person more easily. And next time you spot a flaw in someone else, you'll probably laugh at yourself because you'll realize, my God, even I have some flaws. You won't criticize that person for having that flaw because you would know that there was something in his childhood or upbringing which brought that flaw about. The other thing is, you are calling it a flaw. It may not even be a flaw. That's a judgment on your part. So this acceptance of people for who they are starts playing in your life, and you will realize that life becomes more and more peaceful, more and more centered in the present moment, because you cannot go away from it. The thinking mind is what is going away. So next time you are involved in thinking and the involvement snaps, just say thank you to God, because He has shown you that your peace was there throughout. And one last thing I want to touch on, which I had a conversation with Sheetal and Khushru yesterday, was how we are just shuttling between pleasure and pain. You know, like a tennis match, we are just bouncing between one pain and one pleasure and one pain and one pleasure. That is everyone's experience. But once enough years have gone by, you realize that life is always pain and pleasure. And are you not tired of shuttling and waiting for the next pleasure and trying to avoid the next pain? But it's impossible. Because life is pleasure and pain. So what is one looking for? One is looking for peace. A peace which does not depend on a pleasure or depend on the absence of a pain. And some of us who have suffered enough will realize that that peace is far more greater than a joy which depends on a pleasure, because that's going to go. What is going to stay is peace. And so much we are dependent on things which are transient for our pleasures. If someone says something good, we feel great. That person says something bad, we feel bad and we suffer. It's always so dependent on people and objects. But deep down, it is our experience that in deep sleep, there's no shuttling between pleasure and pain, and that is peace. Therefore, I passed a statement which I read about my teacher. He said for 30 years, he had a migraine headache. One day it stopped. And that day he realized that the absence of pain is the greatest pleasure. Could any pleasure for him be more than that when the suffering of a 30-year migraine stopped? If God came to him and said, "Can I give you something pleasurable?" He will say, "No, just see my migraine doesn't come back again." So you stop getting very reactive to pleasures and pains. You will not sink low to the depths of suffering. You will not go to the highs. You'll start getting in an even keel. It can't work just one way, you know. You can't just enjoy pleasures and not suffer pains. That won't happen. Duality is not built that way. But there will be an underlying current of peace, because you know, all pleasures come and go. All pains come and go. This too shall pass, words of the Bible. This too shall pass. And the only thing which doesn't pass in life is the fact that you are conscious till your last breath. So this living teaching, what I refer to, points you back. Whenever things are going on, just look at things as they are, and you'll just feel that presence of consciousness taking whatever form it is meant to take in the life. Even when you're suffering, if someone ill is in the hospital, you will realize, I'm not running away from this. I'm there 100%. What runs away is the thinking mind. I don't want to be here. Why am I here? When is this person going to go out? But if that is what the moment is throwing up, you stop claiming ownership of that, of what you feel. And then you are with what is happening. If someone is seriously ill, you're there as the presence, allowing it to be, not as a separate packet of an individual. You're honoring what consciousness has thrown up. And then what you are meant to do, whether it is to have a consult with the doctor, see what is to be done, automatically happens and flows. But there's no resistance to what the moment is throwing up. The minute there's resistance, you realize that you are invested in what has happened as a separate ego with a sense of doership.